Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined from Tallahassee by Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy, and from Palm Beach by Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns. Hello, gentlemen.
Hi, Zach.
Hey, Zach. Glad to be here.
Florida is setting records for new coronavirus cases this week, and Governor Ron DeSantis is on the defensive, with critics saying he is letting the outbreak spiral out of control. Meanwhile, John Bolton dropped some bombshell revelations about Trump and his new book that could reverberate in Florida politics. Qualifying has come to an end, and Democrats are fielding a full slate of candidates for legislative seats. And Florida is bracing for a big, big spectacle when the Republican National Convention comes to Jacksonville in August. We'll talk about all that and more, but first, y'all know what that music means. Gentlemen, you have your numbers today. John, how about you?
Yeah, Zach, I've got a number this week that either sounds like a very good, maybe too good, temperature reading in this age of coronavirus, or if your house is like mine, it's a sign that your thermometer is broken. But my number this week is 93.2.
93.2. All right. So I guess you passed the screening this week. Antonio, how about you?
You want to play the, just a little side of that with a 92.
92. All right. I'm going to slide in under both of you guys with a 17. That's 93.2 for John, 92 for Antonio, and 17 for me. Remember those numbers, folks. Write them down. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, the coronavirus outbreak has been a big political roller coaster for DeSantis. He took a lot of heat for being slow to lock down the state, and then took a victory lap of sorts when it looked like the outbreak wasn't that bad in Florida. He started reopening the state, but as the reopening has picked up, so has the daily number of coronavirus cases. The state has been setting records for new daily case totals over the past week, with 4 days of more than 2,000 cases. Now the governor again is under fire. Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, the only statewide elected Democrat, sent out a blistering press release this week accusing DeSantis of mismanaging the coronavirus response and being reckless with his reopening strategy. The governor has defended his approach and argued that the increase in cases was to be expected and is partly the result of increased testing. DeSantis has declared that he's not going to roll back his reopening push. John, we're really in uncharted waters with all this, and the governor seems to be going with his gut instincts, which is to try and protect the economy and individual freedoms as much as possible, even if it means taking some heat from his critics. Is that tenable if we see cases continue to increase significantly?
Yeah, that's a good question. It seems that DeSantis this week tried to make it clear that that reopening door only swings one way, and once the state has been reopened, there's no going back. But that seemed to be the message he said this week as he, even as we're seeing the state shattering another record for daily increases in coronavirus, and it became three times in less than a week that a new daily high was reached. It's really stunning numbers now that we're seeing, as it's, you know, topping 2,000 cases easily on a daily basis, it seems. Now, DeSantis has tried to explain away these increases. He's pointing to the state's heightened level of testing, which is true. The state has finally reached levels that public health experts say that it needs to be at, and that it had struggled to reach for so long through, you know, the month of March and April and May. And also he says that there have been clusters of cases involving farm workers. And he is saying that there's a lot of positive tests involving younger people, age 40 or so, who have returned to the workplace and who, when sick with coronavirus, don't seem to be needing hospitalization. And, the belief is they're not going to turn up as a fatality. But this is an older state with, 20% of the population is age 65 and older. And the governor himself has said that this is a much more vulnerable demographic for the virus. And that is also a fairly significant consumer population. And I think it's pretty safe to say, anecdotally at least, that a lot of people in this age group have changed their habits and are wary about going out to bars, restaurants, and tourist hotels where they may interact with virus carriers. So that rise in cases is going to be a drag on the economy as people don't go out and spend. They're worried sure. about catching, you know, they're worried about catching the virus if they bump into one of these seemingly healthy 40-year-olds at a restaurant or some other social gathering.
Yeah, and older people are the ones that tend to have more money to spend. I mean, the governor seems to be sort of saying, well, we can let this virus spread in the lower risk population, people who are younger and healthier, but that sort of seems to be acknowledging that the spread could get out of control. And if it does, a lot of older people are going to be wary of going out and spending money. That's really going to continue to depress the economy, isn't it?
Sure. If you take at least some share of that 20% of your state's population out of the economy, that's going to pull everything and everyone down. So DeSantis is kind of dreaming if he can convince people that hospital beds are plentiful and, there's nothing to worry about if you want to go out to a happy hour and head to a restaurant and, come this fall, drop your kids off at school and then go over to see the grandparents on the weekend. But, Floridians are taking a signal from DeSantis. They seem, they basically see him not wearing a mask, talking upbeat about getting out and spending, reopening the economy and keeping the state rolling. And they're also getting sick at a level that has not been seen even in the worst days in March that led to the April shutdown. But, DeSantis at one time was considered a fairly savant politician, the way the state's coronavirus levels were never really reached, at least to the dramatically high levels that a lot of people thought they were going to hit. That was all before the April shutdown, and that really sort of slowed the increase and, stopped the curve. But now in reopening, the governor's smart guy image is getting dinged up, and we all know that President Trump needs a very strong performance from DeSantis in the state to shore up his chances of carrying Florida and its big electoral count in November. So there's a lot riding on these daily virus numbers.
Antonio, John mentioned that DeSantis, not really wearing a mask in public. He has sometimes, but not a whole lot. What do you make of that and the whole mask policy that came up this week? He was asked about, requiring masks for businesses and for people going out in public. And he said he's not going to do it right now. Some states are doing that. Some countries are doing that. The city of St. Petersburg here in Florida, their mayor, Rick Kreisman, came out. I believe it was yesterday, and said that he's going to require business employees to wear masks. This is something that you could do, still keep businesses open, but try and prevent people from spreading the virus to one another. Why do you think the governor is wary of requiring masks?
Well, in part because his political godfather, President Donald Trump, has been so opposed to the use of a mask. And that is their base. The signal to the base is that this is not necessary and that this is all part of a democratic hoax and an incursion on freedoms, on personal freedoms. And I'll share this anecdote. Yesterday, I was down in Miami visiting folks, and I went to La Carreta, which is one of the big Cuban chain restaurants, waiting for a coffee in the line. One of the ladies in front who was paying, as soon as she's done paying, she turns to all of us, and we're all wearing a mask. She is also wearing a mask, and she says that, points to her mask and says that this has nothing to do with health, and that if you don't vote Republican, this is going to be a communist country come next year. This has become a political issue, a personal freedom issue, not a public health question. So, in fact, if you look at this nightmare scenario that you and John were just talking about, the rise in cases and the boomerang on the economy, irrespective of whether we close up or not, and I agree with what John has said, that door is only swinging one way. But if you look at that nightmare scenario, that it could be avoided, because if you look at all the data that clearly shows that wearing a mask in public really does protect and really does hold back the infection rate, you know, that we could avoid that nightmare scenario with something as easy as wearing a mask until we get a vaccine. And to not do so, that the political jeopardy here is significant. And it really comes down to just the politicizing of wearing a mask or not.
Yeah, if you take the politics out of it, public health experts are saying that, you know, that it could significantly reduce transmission by just everybody wearing masks, especially indoors. You know, there's a lot of, it sounds like people are saying now that really a lot of these transmissions happen indoors with close person-to-person contact, and that wearing a mask could prevent a lot of those transmissions. But it does seem to be a huge political football right now. Well, few presidents have dealt with more challenging issues heading into a reelection than Trump, who is confronting a tough trifecta with the public health debate surrounding the coronavirus, the economic downturn from the virus, and the racial justice protests that we've seen in recent weeks. But Trump's former national security advisor added to the list of controversies this week by claiming in his new book that Trump sought help from Chinese President Xi Jinping with his reelection. Bolton alleges that Trump pushed Jinping to buy U.S. farm products, which he said would help his election prospects. The controversy echoes the drama in Ukraine that got Trump impeached, with the president accused of leveraging U.S. military aid to force Ukraine to help his reelection bid by investigating the Bidens. Antonio, Florida's Republican leaders, including U.S. Senator Rick Scott and U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, have been very critical of China and really, you know, very explicit that the country is an adversary and that, you know, their interests are not aligned with our interests. You think they might be concerned that Trump would go soft on China if he's trying to get the country's help with his reelection, but Scott and Rubio and most Republicans very rarely cross Trump, who commands a very loyal base. Do you think this revelation by Bolton will cause them any heartburn?
Yeah, this would be a massive dose of heartburn here because of the revelations. I mean, number one, this is China. And like you just stated, basically, you've had Marco Rubio and Rick Scott really out there, extraordinarily critical of China, particularly with the Hong Kong protests and calling on China to respect, you know, the rights of the protesters. And what we're hearing from the Bolton book, the excerpts that have come out, not just that Trump was apparently currying the favor of Xi Jinping for his own reelection interest, but also when the idea of marking the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square uprising, that Trump had no interest in that. That's just not a good look for both Rubio and Scott in their campaigns to win freedoms for the protesters in Hong Kong and in general, their bashing of
and the Uyghur population that's in basically concentration camps.
Exactly.
Blamed China for not controlling the virus and not being transparent about the virus. A lot of criticism on multiple fronts from those two senators.
Of course, yeah. So this is just not a good look. And there are other excerpts here that in terms of Florida politics, and particularly South Florida politics, they're going to bear watching, and particularly the excerpts that we've seen on Venezuela. You know, number one, that at one point, and as we know that there has been the last number of years, this rebellion in Venezuela against the dictatorship of Nicolas Maduro, and that Trump and both Rubio and Scott and DeSantis have weighed into this. This is in their quote-unquote sphere of influence. It's Latin America. And they have been very vocal about supporting the protesters and the opposition movement in Venezuela. And here we have, at one point, Trump discussing military options. And the reason this is kind of important is because apparently, and you know, we haven't read the book yet, but the excerpt suggests that when the military options were put on the table, that Rubio and Scott and DeSantis seemed, quote unquote, stunned. We haven't explained what their position was. But bear in mind that Trump, his hardcore base in South Florida, particularly among the most conservative Cubans, which is the Bay of Pigs crowd. I mean, for decades, they have lamented that at the Bay of Pigs, that Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, who was the president at the time, did not use a military option. He did not give the invaders the air support necessary to make the invasion succeed. Instead, it was just a fiasco, and that, you know, just a tragic failure and defeat. So that hardline is going to go ahead and say, wait a minute, hold on a second. You mean President Trump was putting military options on the table, and you, Senator Scott and Rubio, you didn't go along with this? There's going to be some explaining to do there to the hardline, the most hardline voters. The other part of this expert, when it seems that Trump is waffling on support for the leader of the assembly, Juan Guaido, who has been now recognized as, quote unquote, the official president of Venezuela, although he, you know, Nicolas Maduro maintains control of the company, of the country, you know, that Trump seems to be waffling on Guaido after he has a conversation with Vladimir Putin, who compares Guaido, apparently, again, we haven't read of the book, but the excerpt suggests that that Putin compares Guaido to Hillary Clinton, and then Trump starts waffling. And if that comes out true, this is going to be really problematic, because the one area of bipartisan support here among South Florida Democrats and Republicans is support for Juan Guaido. And if it looks like Trump was not on board with Juan Guaido, this is going to give a lot of ammunition to South Florida Democrats to say, aha, see, we told you that this guy is not, that President Trump is not trustworthy on this issue. And here he was waffling on the one guy that we need in order to restore democracy to Venezuela. So
And Putin is obviously an ally of Cuba and of Maduro, right? I mean, that would basically be Trump taking the advice of these socialist, communist, dictator countries, basically.
Exactly. And, you know, Putin is a former KGB. You know, he's a Soviet. I mean, that's the way that he's looked at in Miami. He's a Soviet. He's not a Russian president. He's a Soviet. He's a throwback to this era. And, you know, to have been taking that advice and perhaps waffling on Guaido, that could be very damaging. And remember, it's not that there's going to be seismic political shifts here. It's not like the huge blocks are going to change their minds because of the John Bolton book. But John Bolton is definitely a hero to the conservative Latino voters in South Florida, Cubans, Venezuelans, Colombians down the road. And for him to say this, that's going to carry weight. And remember, you know, among those voting blocks, it's close to 1 million voters in South Florida, more or less. If you just shave 1% of that, that's 10,000 votes. That's Rick Scott's margin of victory in 2018 over Bill Nelson. If you shave off 3% of the vote, that's 30,000 votes. That's Ron DeSantis' margin of victory in 2018 against Andrew Gillum. So, you know, we're talking about margins here, fractions that this could turn, and this could get pretty interesting in terms of when we get closer and closer to November 3rd.
Well, you make a good point, Antonio. This isn't like some revelation coming from a government insider. This is from somebody who's been a GOP hawk for many years and has, a lot of credibility within the Republican establishment. So this might hit closer to the mark than some of the other revelations that we've seen. Well, as these controversies rage, we are creeping closer to election time here in Florida. Qualifying for state and local races ended last week, so the playing field is now set, and it's always interesting to see how the parties did in recruiting, especially for legislative races. Republicans have controlled both the state house and senate for two decades now. John, Democrats always say that they're gunning to try and win back a majority. What do you think their chances are this cycle?
Well, Zach, if you're suggesting that Democrats are blowing smoke when they think they can take back these houses, you've seen a little bit of history, and it does seem to happen that every election season, the Democrats get close, but not close enough. In the House, they need to pick up 14 seats to win a majority. Now, that's not going to happen, no matter how controversial President Trump's tweets may get, or how bad the state's unemployment compensation performs, or how high the jobless rate gets. Now the Senate, though, is closer. Four additional seats would give Democrats the majority, and maybe that is within range in a sea change kind of election year. We certainly have the issues in play this year with the coronavirus and unemployment both spiking and a president, controversial president at that, seeking re-election. But last week, candidate qualifying ended, and the Democrats fielded almost a full slate of candidates, 119 candidates in 120 House seats up for grabs, and candidates in all 21 Senate seats to be on the ballot. That's notable in that most years there are a couple of dozen seats that don't get challenged by either party, or you know, by one party or the other. So you often have a lot of candidates that get sort of free passes to re-election. This year, the Democrats almost ran the table when it came to getting people in all the seats. That's better than the Republicans did this year, who left 22 House and Senate seats with no Republican candidates, including 10 where an incumbent Democrat is going to be elected without opposition. Clearly, though, some districts are more winnable than others for Democrats, and the quality of the candidate that the Democrats has fielded, that's still sort of an unknown, and we can't make any judgments just based on the numbers. And it probably varies significantly in those 140 seats now where there will be a Democrat on the ballot. But State Democratic Chair Terry Rizzo, she's clearly banking on something of a reflexive vote in some areas by Florida voters. She thinks there are many voters that are just tired of President Trump and frustrated by Republican government in this state, feelings that, have been heightened by the tough times that we are in right now. So the question is going to be, can Democrats do it? The party has been in a minority now for more than two decades in Tallahassee. That's a very long time. And they came about 33,000 votes short of capturing the governor's mansion 2 years ago, which would have led to a major shakeup of state government. But, now they have a equally tall order, maybe even taller, trying to fight it out in each of these House and Senate districts and banking on Florida voters to be ready to switch horses. Sometimes after riding the Republican Party now since the Jeb Bush era. But it would seem that if ever there was a year for massive change, it may be this one. And maybe winning those four Senate seats is what they need, to gain that majority. And that's what they need to start taking their first steps back toward relevancy in the state.
Yeah, and you can't win if you don't even have a candidate. And as you said, this is pretty tumultuous political climate right now. You never know what could happen with the coronavirus and the economy the way it is, and some of these other issues out there. John, one reason why these legislative races are so important this year is because there's going to be redistricting soon, and the state legislative seats and the congressional seats are going to be redrawn, and there's always a big battle about how you draw these seats and whether they're skewed to help the party in power. If the Democrats win control of at least one chamber, they would have a say, right? I mean, they had no say.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because we are at a point where whatever redistricting is redrawn, that'll come along in 2022. That's going to affect the state for the next decade, and to a degree, one of the ways that the Republicans claimed dominance in this state was winning redistricting battles back in the 90s. Where the map started changing, and Florida started electing Republicans, up and down the state, and of course, there were efforts by independent groups that had the support of the Democratic Party in the 2000s, aimed at trying to create fair districts where there were certain guidelines set for how redistricting had to be enacted. But the party is still hampered by the kind of districts that have been drawn. They have gotten better. They have gotten a little bit more equitable with the last round of redistricting. But you're right. If the Democrats can have one chamber of the legislature, that's going to be significant when it comes to negotiating on these maps that are ultimately going to be what guides the state for the next decade.
And it's worth noting that Democrats have relied on the courts to enforce those fair districts amendments, and they did get some favorable Supreme Court rulings that forced Republicans to redraw congressional and legislative districts, but the Supreme Court has been reconfigured by Governor Ron DeSantis to make it more conservative. So who knows what would happen, you know, in the future if the redistricting plan was brought to that court. Well, Democrats may have their sights set on making gains in Florida, but Republicans are eager to keep the state red for Trump and down the ballot. Holding part of the Republican National Convention in Jacksonville could help Republicans pump up their base. The RNC formally made the move to Jacksonville last week after North Carolina's governor balked at allowing a full convention. Antonio, Trump has been struggling in the polls. He probably needs to win Florida to have a shot at winning re-election. Do you think holding the convention here could help him hold on to the state?
Well, it would certainly help energize his already energized base. I mean, last weekend on Sunday, June 14th, was the president's 74th birthday. It was marked across Florida by a lot of rallies, including boat rallies. And here in South Florida, we had, you know, somewhere between 300 and 400 boats parading up in Jacksonville. You saw more or less the same. It's, you know, his base is stoked here in the state. And we've seen that in polls, that even though he seems to be trailing Joe Biden, if on the enthusiasm question, Republican voters have said that they're much more enthusiastic about voting for Trump than Democratic voters said that they were enthusiastic about voting for Joe Biden. So the enthusiasm, he doesn't lack here in Florida. Certainly holding this part of the convention, let's face it, the convention is going to be here. The notables are going to be here. I would be shocked if Donald Trump set one foot in North Carolina for that part of the convention. So I think that, you know, that clearly it'll help him whip up the base. Remember, Jacksonville, depending on who you talk to, is either Northeast Florida or Southeast Georgia. So that helps him reach out into his base in Georgia, because that's another state where he could use some shoring up in. Now the price of all this is that he may end up losing North Carolina if folks there get deflated by the fact that they've lost that convention. So this is going to be interesting. It's going to be an interesting few days in Jacksonville at the end of August, particularly what we've seen with the coronavirus issues and an indicator of how much enthusiasm will be there. We'll see on Saturday with this rally up in Tulsa, where now Trump is going to start hitting the road again. And this convention is going to be very much a 3-day rally. It's going to be the same formula, I would suspect.
Yeah, and it could be pretty wild if the coronavirus is still raging by the time this convention is going on in August, which almost seems like an almost certainly will be. There were some stories this week about a bar on Jacksonville Beach where dozens of people tested positive for the coronavirus after an outing one night. So, there's lots of questions about safety surrounding this. I was talking to Florida GOP Chair Joe Gruters this week, and he didn't think that masks would be required at the convention. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, it would be really interesting if they were, because one of the things that we've seen recently has been this tension between the Trump base, who now call themselves Trumplicans, not Republicans, they're Trumplicans, and the establishment Republican Party. And if the establishment Republican Party mandates masks and the Trumplicans say, no, that's an incursion of our freedom, you could end up with kind of internal strife even among the quote-unquote Republican Party.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to mandate masks unless things get significantly worse, which is a very real possibility. I think you're right. I mean, they would face a bit of a revolt, and I don't think that they want to have that going into the convention, but we'll see. Well, we'll move on to some numbers here. We'll go from highest to lowest to 93.2. You want to tell us about that, John?
Yeah, the 93.2 is billion dollars, and that's the size of the state budget that was sent to Governor DeSantis this week for him to sign for the year beginning July 1st. Now take a good look at it, because that $93.2 billion budget is headed right for the history books, at least in the size it is currently. And it was passed by the legislature back in mid-March, when the impact of the coronavirus on the economy was nowhere near envisioned. So how does DeSantis handle this budget that state tax collections show, it just can't be seen as meeting? We're not taking in the revenue that is needed to finance this $93.2 billion budget. We've seen March's tax collections alone come in almost $900 million less than anticipated. So for starters, DeSantis can veto plenty of projects. This week, DeSantis likened his veto plans to the Red Wedding slaughter in the Game of Thrones HBO series. So that gives you some idea of what he's thinking. He'll likely veto maybe something close to $1 billion from the budget. And the state has close to $3.9 billion in reserves, which at least could be used to fill in some gaps. And then the federal government also has steered $4.6 billion to Florida to help cover state spending on the coronavirus. The definition of that can probably be kind of loosely applied and could cover, some basic state needs. But the governor is going to have to weigh spending almost $1 billion on teacher pay raises and state worker pay raises. That's included in the budget. And more than $600 million on environmental projects, another thing that he has championed but could be at risk right now. These were all spending items that were put into the budget back when tax revenues seemed plentiful. But the Republican-led legislature does not want to come back into special session to cut. So they're letting DeSantis call all the shots on the budget that they spent months putting together. They know that a special session would allow Democrats to raise questions about what programs are being cut, the state's woeful performance in getting unemployment checks out to Floridians, vote by mail measures that are still undecided heading toward an election season, and a whole bunch of other controversial issues that are just going to cast a cloud over President Trump's reelection chances in this, the nation's biggest toss-up state. So watch for DeSantis to do all the heavy lifting on the budget, and he'll do it very soon, since it takes effect in less than 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's never good for those who care about the state budget when the governor compares his cuts to a scene in a television show where everybody in the room is slaughtered. That's the Red Wedding episode of Game of Thrones. I don't know if we learned something new about DeSantis, but I don't know if it was known that he was such a
Game Evidently. Of Thrones. HBO subscriber, maybe.
Yeah. Got to have something to get you through the lockdown. Well, Antonio, your number was 92. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, 92 is the age of Gene Kennedy Smith, who has passed away. For those of us who watch Palm Beach and political connections, Gene Kennedy Smith was one of the one of the sisters of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, and Ted Kennedy. And in her own right, she was quite the political figure. In the 1990s, she served as U.S. ambassador to Ireland under President Clinton and played a major role in the peace accords that brought, centuries of strife in Northern Ireland between Protestants and Catholics to an end. Now, for those of us who watch this really closely, there's another claim to fame or infamy associated with her down here in Palm Beach politics, and that is that in 1991, her son, William Kennedy Smith, was accused of rape over an Easter weekend that the Kennedy family was at a time they were spending an Easter weekend down here in Palm Beach. And in fact, Ted Kennedy was here with William Kennedy Smith at the time of this incident, this allegation. They eventually ended up in William Kennedy Smith, Gene Kennedy Smith's son, being charged with rape. He went to trial. It was the trial of the century until the OJ trial, the other trials of the century that soon followed, but this one was one of the most high-profile trials, criminal trials, in Florida history of the 20th century, and he was defended by Roy Black, who is, one of the most famous criminal attorneys out there. And the interesting thing is that the theme of, powerful people taking advantage of women really was at the forefront. And William Kennedy Smith ultimately was acquitted. But later that year, George H.W. Bush, who was president, nominated Clarence Thomas to the court. And then Clarence Thomas was accused of sexual harassment. And that became, you know, the Anita Hill hearings. And again, brought the issue of powerful men taking advantage of women to the forefront. Still, Clarence Thomas made it to the Supreme Court, has served as a justice ever since. But, you know, fast forward two decades later, social media, the Me Too movement, you know, you wonder what would have happened back in 1991 if, you know, if there had been social media and there had been a Me Too movement, and, you know, how that trial and how that entire case, came about and was resulted. But nonetheless, that's a connection. But Jean Kennedy Smith has passed away. She is the last surviving sibling of the Kennedy clan that created a American political dynasty like none we have seen before, really none since we've seen since. I mean, maybe the Bushes with George H.W. and George W. Bush both reaching the presidency. But she has passed away. And again, like I said, it's a figure in her own right, given the monumental peace accord in Northern Ireland, a place it seemed that violence and strife would be intractable forever. And she played a major role in ending that, the quote unquote, the troubles and bringing peace to Northern Ireland.
Well, that's fascinating. Antonio, sometimes I think that being a political writer in Palm Beach is like one of the best jobs out there. You got the Kennedys, the Trumps. I mean, there's no shortage of really high profile figures that come through that area. And very interesting to hear about the early echoes of Me Too there. Sometimes progress takes a while, but hopefully you get there eventually. Well, my number is 17. Absentee ballots are sent out for military and overseas voters for Florida's primary election in just 17 days on July 4th. And absentee ballots start going out for domestic voters 5 days later on July 9th. So the election is really just around the corner. And Governor Ron DeSantis has been under pressure to give election officials more flexibility because of the voting challenges that coronavirus presents. The supervisors of elections for all 67 counties in Florida sent DeSantis a letter. They wanted the authority to consolidate polling places because of an expected shortage of poll workers and facilities that can be used for voting. They also wanted to extend early voting to help avoid crowds on election day, which has been a problem in Florida in the past. And DeSantis, well, he finally acted on the supervisor's request this week. He didn't extend early voting and he didn't authorize consolidating polling places, but he did ask schools to close on both the primary and general election day to free up those buildings to use as polling places. And he did issue an executive order allowing state workers to take time off to serve as poll workers. We'll see if that's enough to avoid Florida becoming another national laughingstock again this election season. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Cordy and Joseph Rosano. And thanks to all of you for listening. Stay safe. We're out of here.